Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longstanding journalist covering health, food, the environment, and social policy, science, and activism. And I report on a variety of venues, as well as every week this show on the Progressive Radio Network, going into ending our fourth year and going into our fifth soon, which is very exciting. Every week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between your personal well-being and that of our total environment, which includes our neighborhoods, our homes, our communities, our regions, our states, our society, our policies, as well as planet Earth. You know, very often when we have like any kind of problem in well-being, it's an individual problem. It's seen as an individual problem or a problem for our family. We kind of struggle with it. But we always need to remember that what shows up in our lives as a personal problem has personal components completely unique to you and to me and to everyone. But at the same time, they're also larger larger influences from our society and our policy decisions and our total environment, our culture, our beliefs, and the things that we choose as a society to act on or not act on. So every week on this show, we kind of talk about the larger context and bring in different thought leaders, experts, authors, scientists, advocates to discuss different facets of what is affecting the earth politic, the body politic, and our own well-being. So that's what we do every week on Connect the Dots. And if you're interested in following these things more closely, you can sign up on my website, healthjournalistblog.com, friend me on Facebook on Connecting the Dots on Health, and you'll receive regular weekly announcements of, you know, the current show, as well as it's a good reference to our past archives along with the PRN website. Like many people, you know, people who love democracy, people who are concerned about justice, people who care about all people, you know, not just themselves or their own individual groups, I've been very distressed, as I know many of you listeners have, by some of the goings-on in our world. It's just been, you know, really upsetting to see changes going in the wrong direction in terms of who is being protected and who is being harmed and how law enforcement is overstepping, you know, sort of traditional, what we think of as traditional controls in a democracy. And so on today's show, I'm bringing back a guest that we've had before, who's someone who I think makes an important contribution to this, the dialogue about these issues, and is a leader in this area. This is Jean Marie Doré. She is the National Issue Team Coordinator at Progressive Democrats of America. She grew up in a family that has always made politics and public service a part of their lives. Yay! And in fact, she has a number of distinguished ancestors and relations that, you know, have been active in a variety of roles. In the past few years, Jean Marie has worked with the Illinois Democratic Women, We Are Wisconsin, Organizing for America, and she has been with Progressive Democrats for America, where she again serves as a national issue team coordinator. And that means that, you know, in that job, she's looking at what goes on nationwide as well as looking at the issues that are really core leverage issues for protecting citizens, assuring social justice, and maintaining and promoting democracy. So we'll be talking a lot about Ferguson on this show, where she has spent time on the ground, as well as branching out to a number of interrelated issues as the issues raised by Ferguson have evolved, sadly, further in the wrong direction at the time of this taping. So welcome once again to Connect the Dots, Jean.
Thank you so much, Allison. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. You know, it's sort of, to me, a bit poignant. Back when we first had planned this program and scheduled it, we were going to be talking about Ferguson, because you have spent significant time in that community and really have a tremendous grasp, which I think will be fascinating for our listeners, about the lessons learned and the evolution there and what's, you know, what that community is addressing and their level of conscious awareness and hard work protecting themselves and dealing with some of the issues that have rumbled up. Since that time, we have the more recent event of, you know, the ruling about what went on there, as well as the ruling about in the Eric Garner case in my own hometown of New York. So we'll be talking about all of that on today's show. But let's begin with Ferguson, because that really... you know, that's the historical context for what I would consider a kind of revelation of deeply embedded injustice and even a devolution in democracy. So tell our listeners, if you would, a little bit about your work in Ferguson and, you know, what some of the lessons from that community are for all of us.
Thanks, Allison. I think in terms of my work in Ferguson, I would say it's less about the work that we've been doing and more about the work that the community of Ferguson is doing. Mm-hmm. They've been very conscious of the fact that this is a movement that has to happen from within that community, from within themselves. They have been very protective of their movement. They have talked about the fact that they actually do want to keep out a large number of groups unless they're willing to work under the umbrella of Ferguson in the Ferguson community. They have been very vocal about not wanting to be co-opted, and I think that's really good. I think that's an excellent thing for them to do, because I think that happens often with a lot of movements, whether they be social movements, civil rights movements, environmental movement. It doesn't matter what movement you're talking about, that does happen, and they are very conscious of that as an issue.
Let's just talk about that for a minute or two, because, you know, that is something that as a reporter and talking to many advocacy groups, I hear a lot of, you know, information that's off the record in that regard. And yet, you know, so I'm aware of it, but it's something that I don't think a lot of people are aware of. You know, very often, just speaking for myself as a reporter, I'll have heard bad reports on the actions of, you know, a certain group from multiple parties, for example, you know, that from multiple different sectors. And yet, you know, a friend or a member of the general public will come to me and say something like, oh, such and such group, isn't that a great group? You know, and so a group, you know, we're not here to badmouth people on our own side. And but some groups do have mixed records in terms of, you know, is their work doing, the work they're doing, really seeding grassroots evolution and web building, or are they kind of sucking out from the roots in order to build their own big profile? Could you just orient our listeners a little bit to that kind of thinking? Because sometimes it comes as a big shock when a group that we thought was on our side is now coming out against, you know, important issues that everyone else is kind of agreeing with, and this is kind of how it happens. So what are your thoughts on that?
Sure. You know, as you said, I'm not going to name names of organizations.
Right.
It happens on the right. It happens on the left. It happens in the not-for-profit sector. It happens all across the board. But what typically happens is probably the thing that most people are familiar with is you get the email in your inbox and it says, please donate $3 or $5 or $25 or whatever you can afford. So that way you can help us do X, Y, or Z, help us get so-and-so elected, help us get boots on the ground to help with this important issue, help us whatever it might be. But what we often see with these organizations is that no boots are on the ground. the amount of work being done in terms of an election may be minimal or non-existent. Mm-hmm. The amount of effort being put into something may not be any effort at all except to talk about it. And so what ends up happening is you're donating money to an organization that you believe is actually doing something in relation to that issue, when in fact what they may be doing is very little, if not anything at all. And that happens far more frequently than anybody would like to admit. And I know oftentimes we'll hear, well, you know, we have to get our staff paid, and we have to do this, and we have to do that. And yes, those things are important, because if you don't have staff, you can't execute any sort of plan. However, if, you know, you put out a call for donations and $30,000 comes in the door that week in relation to that issue, and the only thing you do is have a table full of volunteers make a few phone calls that didn't cost the organization any money, then the question has to be is, where is that money really going, and would that money be better spent being given directly to the campaign, whether it be issue-based or candidate-based? And so this is a problem. And one of the things, which I will say, because it was in the national news, when Reverend Jesse Jackson and Reverend Al Sharpton both came into Ferguson, the Ferguson community asked them to leave, because they were fearful of their movement being co-opted by something else. And so this is a real concern, and it's something I think that I think most activist movements, people who are truly a piece of what is happening, it truly is a part of their community, it truly is a part of who they are and affects them on a personal level. I think they need to be aware of this. And I really have been impressed by the Ferguson community and their deep awareness of this and willingness to say it very bluntly, stay out. You will not co-opt our movement.
Wow. That's really interesting. You know, for many people, it's kind of like, you know, getting involved in activism is a good thing, something to be encouraged. But it also, you know, part of that is, you know, not necessarily going with the biggest profile people, but, you know, kind of drilling in to find out who are the people doing work on the ground. What are other lessons from Ferguson and how they've handled themselves?
I think one of the other very intelligent things that the community has done is to not neglect the body of work that has been done in the past in relation to civil rights, particularly in relation to people of color and the African-American community specifically. Some of the meetings that I attended there, particularly through the Organization for Black Struggle, the people that they brought into that meeting were a spectrum of people that were going to be very valuable voices in this organizing towards equality and freedom and having civil rights that are respected in Ferguson, Missouri, and throughout the country. Those people were young people from the city and communities in and around Ferguson. They were also people who actually had been part of the formation of the original Black Panther Party. There were people there who were involved in the civil rights movement at its inception back in the 50s and 60s. And so you had a broad spectrum of voices with a broad spectrum of experience that, and when they sat down to talk about it, all of those voices were considered of value and considered to be very important, because this was looked at as a long-term struggle that had been going on in this country for literally centuries. And it was not looked at, which often happens, in terms of what's happening right now and how somehow often what we see is, oh, the fight has changed. you know, we're in the modern world and things are different. And really, in a sense, they are not. Mm-hmm. And that is what the whole problem is. They are not. We need to learn from the history of what's happened before, because essentially what we're letting happen is the same things over and over again. So if mm-hmm. we're not calling on history as a witness, if we're not calling on the people who were there, who witnessed that history, to be able to guide our hand now, we are losing an immense amount of information that we need to combat these issues so that we're not constantly starting over again.
Mm-hmm. Is there a tendency for there to be this kind of urgency around today that kind of leads people to block off those lessons and to forget to make that continuity with history and the people who carry it, in your opinion? I mean, do you see that all?
I think there is, and I think that has to do with a number of things. Mm-hmm. In the activist community, and oftentimes I think our leadership is very young, mm-hmm. and I think thus being part of being young is it being about now. It's what I know. It's what's in front of me. It's youthful exuberance. It's there and now, and that's really important to have in a movement, because we need that kind of energy to make it go.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what also ends up happening is some of our older leaders who have been on the block for a while, they've moved on to other things, and they've moved out of those leadership roles in a lot of activist communities, and we lose that voice. And so I think it's really important to bring that back in. And that's what we're seeing happening in Ferguson, which is so vitally important to making this move. I think the other piece of it is that, you know, if you want to talk about the overall society, we've moved into a society where everything is now. Now. We have to look at what's important now. And even with the way our government runs, with the way policy is made, with the way pretty much everything is being done, we're often discouraged from looking at past history to make those decisions, because we want everything to happen now. And it's when we start thinking in terms of this now that we start making very poor decisions, because they're uninformed decisions. And this has just permeated the entire culture of the United States, and I'm sure other countries as well, but very much so here. And we need to step back, and we need to reexamine what's going on, and we need to really, again, go back and place an emphasis on history, on logical thought, on how it is we get from point A to point B without repeating the same mistakes. Because, you know, I think most people are familiar with the phrase that, you know, those who don't know their history are doomed to repeat it.
Mm-hmm.
And we're doing an awful lot of that these days. And mm-hmm. I think it's incredible that the people of Ferguson have come together and said, you know, we don't have any plans on repeating this, if at all possible. We want to mm-hmm. put a stop to this now, and we are going to look at that history, and we are going to bring in those other voices, and we're going to examine this carefully, and we are going to look at other alternative avenues that we haven't looked at before, as opposed to continuously doing the same things over and over again that don't work.
Mm-hmm. Can you give a few examples of places where you see us repeating?
I think, you know, one of the things, I'll give a very specific example that is happening in Ferguson right now. One of the things that was discussed was low voter turnout in Ferguson. Mm-hmm. And so they went in and they did voter registration drives. And when they did those voter registration drives, they came away with very few voter registrants. So not a lot of new people to add to the rolls. When you talk to the people in Ferguson, their commentary often was, well, the Democrats are already in control of this community. Mm-hmm. And we already have a Democratic governor.
Mm-hmm.
And this is still happening. So the question that they have then is, what's the alternative to a Republican or a Democrat considering that we're not getting anywhere under either group in our community? And thus, what they want to look at is, what are the alternatives? Where do we go from here? Is there a different political system? Is there a different political party? How much do we need to change things in order to get beyond where we are now? When you talk about Republican and Democrat, I mean, that also changes as time goes by. You know, Republicans were the ones that were, you know, that freed the slaves and got women the right to vote and started the ERA. But then when you move further down the spectrum, it's Democrats that are the ones who put forth the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act and these sorts of laws to help protect people of color. And, mm-hmm. you know, the parties shift. And it's a two-party system, and we're kind of trapped in this dance where we only have, you know, two choices. It's black or it's white. It's mm-hmm. it's red or it's blue. It's, you know, it's up or it's down. And the world provides a much larger spectrum for people in terms of their choices in reality. And so our political system is definitely not reflecting the reality of the choices that we have to make as citizens, both of this country and of humanity. There's so much that needs to be done. And this is a system that literally confines us and confines our ability to find right solutions.
Mm-hmm. That's going to be a very big issue coming up with, you know, the upcoming presidential elections, which people are turning their eyes to as well. You know, the sense of people, I mean, on media outlets like MSNBC, you have people, you know, analyzing the missteps of the Democrats, you know, in campaigning or whatever. That'll be discussed often. But the overall dilemma of everyone being, you know, both parties in various ways being perceived as kind of dialed in and beholden to these larger forces that are really, you know, kind of playing the tune at this point, thanks to Citizens United, you know, presents, it's like people don't know where to turn. And so, you know, the sense is, what does it matter? And they step back. I mean, are they coming up with any solutions? Because this is a, you know, it's a very important area, obviously.
Yeah, it is. I mean, you know, one of the things that we keep seeing the turn towards is, you know, people like Bernie Sanders, who in fact is not a Democrat or a Republican, even though he caucuses with the Democrats. Mm-hmm. He's often been associated with the Socialist Party and is an independent in the Congress. Mm-hmm. You know, and if people are gravitating towards that, which especially young people, we're seeing a lot of gravitation towards somebody like Bernie Sanders, that is a cue as to where we are. It's telling us something. It's saying that, you know, we want to get young people involved. Well, young people are kind of hard to bullshit with. Mm-hmm. Young people typically see through it very quickly. They may not understand 100% what the problem is, but they're perceptive to know that the problem is there.
Mm-hmm.
And young people clue into this, and they don't want to have anything to do with the Republicans or the Democrats.
That's
because
right.
They're not really representing who they are. Again, it's this black and white choice. You're either this or you're that. Well, you're not. You're a person who is rather complex, who has independent thoughts, and is on a different journey from the person sitting next to you, and your experiences are different and vast. And so, you know, having two parties to choose from, probably in reality, neither one of these parties truly represents any individual person in this country. And especially, mm-hmm. like you said, when you start injecting money and resources, as has been done through Citizens United, mm-hmm. the decision how it's corrupted the political process terribly,
mm-hmm.
it makes it even worse. Because mm-hmm. then, even if there were things that you thought you could ally yourself with in the party, now it seems a bit unstable because the integrity has been taken from that system.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so it really becomes a problem of engagement when the whole system looks corrupt. People are, you know, kind of wanting to I mean, in the circles that I travel in, you know, everybody kind of wants to go off into a small local community and grow food, you know, and go back to the farm.
Right.
And actually, that's obviously highly valuable. You know, it does represent an alternative to conventional agriculture, which both, you know, which has both food, nutritional, and health impacts, as well as environmental impacts. So I don't want to single that out and say that, you know, that's a bad thing to do, because, in fact, it's a very good thing to do. And yet, on every other level at which, you know, we have to address factors, you know, retreat, is not necessarily the best or the only option. What other solutions are emerging, or, you know, like from Ferguson or elsewhere? I mean, in other words, if the Ferguson community could just, you know, in and of themselves at a grassroots level, elect officials manage to make the issue of police overreaching kind of go away, I'm sure they would, but don't they also need help at the national level, because a lot of this is originating at the state level, at the national level? Could you talk about, you know, like, you know, how that goes, like what, you know, the different levels of society where there are solutions need to be sought and enacted beyond the local level?
Sure. I think that is something that the Ferguson community is working on right now. I know that we're still, as Progressive Democrats of America, we're still in the process of having those conversations with the people on the ground in Ferguson and trying to figure out what it is we can do to help them. Because we don't want to co-opt their movement. We think it's fabulous what they're doing. We want them to be strong, and we want them to be in control of their community. So we continue to be involved in the calls. We continue to be involved in one-on-one conversations. We continue to find ways to support their movement. But in terms of what that looks like on the national level or the international level, I think that is very organic, and it is happening as we speak, and I think it's going to change from moment to moment. I know that, yes, they have been looking at running their own candidates. I know there is a group there with Socialist Alternative that did run a candidate in the November election. I know there were residents that I spoke with that were talking about how to essentially create a co-op, if you will, how to create, you know, your own gas station or your own restaurant or your own grocery store that would be community-owned in order to push those corporate interests out of the community and regain control and ownership of their own community and put that ownership back into the hands of the residents. So I think they're looking at something a lot more dramatic than merely getting a few people elected in order to change the laws. They're really examining how to change the entire structure and rip it out at its roots and start over again. And so I don't think this is going to happen fast, but it's going to be serious change if they continue moving in the direction that they are. And I hope they are able to continue to do that, because their goals are high and they're impressive. And if they can attain even some of it, I think it will be a model that other communities can work off of.
That's fantastic. Let's go into our break on that terrific note. And that's very inspiring, and we certainly need that model everywhere. And in the second half of the show, stay with us, listeners. We're talking with Jean Marie Doré of the Progressive Democrats of America about pressing social concerns affecting our democracy and social justice in multiple communities and at multiple levels of our society. We'll be talking, sort of looking beyond Ferguson to other places that we're seeing the same issues reflected in the second half of the show. So please stay with us as we go into our break. Well, well, well. Welcome back, listeners, to the second half of Connect the Dots. I'm again with you, Allison Rose Levy. We're here every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Eastern Time, on the Progressive Radio Network. Today we're talking about Lessons of Ferguson and Beyond with Jean Marie Doré of the Progressive Democrats of America. In the first half of the show, Jean Marie was really cluing us in on both some of the issues on the ground in Ferguson and some of the sort of leadership and modeling of the people in that community are offering to all of us as they ask deeper questions about how we get to the roots of the things that are undermining our democracy and how we address them at local, state, regional, and national levels. Fascinating conversation. If you missed that half of the show, it'll be available in the Connect the Dots archives later this afternoon in the whole total program, archive there. And you can also if you've been enjoying the show and are coming back to rejoin us, let other people know about this exciting conversation. In this half of the show, we'll be talking with Jean Marie Doré about the lessons beyond Ferguson. As I said in the early part of the show, when we planned this program, things had not progressed, or rather devolved would be a more accurate phrase, in terms of the issues of police violence, brutality, injustice, lack of accountability that we've seen in Ferguson. And, you know, if you haven't been following this issue, I think it might be good to do a quick rundown of what went on in Ferguson. Just very briefly, and what's gone on since in terms of interrelated issues of social justice, racism, and police accountability. Jean Marie, would you kind of give our listeners just a 3 to 5 minute like highlights in case they haven't been following this issue?
Of course. Back in August in Ferguson, Missouri, young man Michael Brown and friend were walking down the street. An officer and was driving by. He told them to get out of the street, to walk on the sidewalk. Some altercation occurred, I won't go into the details there, since there's a lot of conflict about the details and what may or may not have happened. But what we do know is that that officer discharged his gun more times than anyone should have in an altercation with a teenager who is unarmed. Mm-hmm. And that resulted in the death of Michael Brown. Typical in such a situation, an officer would probably call other officers to the scene, call for an ambulance, but those things were not done. The officer left the scene, and Michael Brown's body was left in the street for several hours. Mm. What ended up happening later, I believe it was about 4 hours later that the ambulance and other officers finally arrived. The community was outraged. And by the evening, there was a vigil right in the street where this had occurred. There were many, many people who came out. It was older people with walkers. It was people with their babies in strollers. It was everyone in the community coming out that evening because they were so outraged and so upset at what had occurred. When those people gathered who live in that community for reasons that still make no sense, police came in with riot gear and agitated the crowd. And the crowd was agitated. The police continued further by putting tear gas into the crowd, using pepper spray on the crowd, and people fled. And other people became angry. The next thing that happened was the Quick Trip gas station convenience mart in the community was targeted, and yes, there was looting. I know many people have heard about this aspect people in the community of Ferguson do not agree with the looting in terms of, no, that type of violence should not have occurred. However, there are a number of things that people do not realize about Quick Trip. Apparently, Quick Trip has some sort of contract to work as a substation of the St. Louis County Police Department. And this and this is in large part why Quick Trip marts have been the targets of many demonstrations and actions in the St. Louis County area. So it was not a random looting event that necessarily occurred that evening, as much as it was a response to the militarization of the police on a community that was trying to mourn the death of one of their children.
Mm-hmm.
The community, of course, was outraged that they were being attacked by the officers, and thus demonstrations continued every single night. It would begin with a vigil in the street, and with the residents marching to the Ferguson Police Department, which is well over a mile from where this occurred, and they would march to the police department every night to demand answers, and answers that they were never getting. And in fact, when I was in Ferguson and joined the community in going up to the police department in Ferguson, the community was not even allowed onto the property of the police department. They were held at bay across the street. And the street in front of the police department was shut down. No cars could come onto that street. So here they were in their own community going to the police department to ask for answers to questions about the death of a child in their community, and asking questions of the people whose salaries that they pay to protect their community. Mm-hmm. And the response they got was, we are not speaking to you. We are not going to give you any answers. And if you come any closer, we will spray you with tear gas and pepper spray, which is what everyone saw internationally on the news, and it went on and continues to go on to this day.
Mm-hmm.
So that is essentially what has been happening in Ferguson, and it has spread to other communities, as we have seen.
That's thank you for that terrific, you know, and sad rundown to revisit, you know, what went on there. And, you know, and of course, what happens is whenever any of these, whenever a kind of a tragic event or crisis occurs, whether it's in this case, a community crisis of social justice and violence, or whether it's an environmental crisis or a health crisis, any kind of crisis that occurs is always seen as an isolated event because this is a very big country. We hear about these things in the national media. And, you know, we those with a heart and a concern will be upset at even a single incident anywhere. But with the, you know, there being so many such incidents, I mean, gun violence is another example. You know, we it kind of could crop up anywhere, but we hope it won't come to us. And similarly, you know, I think, you know, speaking as a white person, I'm not proud to say this, but, you know, certainly for many of us who are white people or comfortable or live far from the scene, there can be, you know, a thought of, oh, this is, you know, just a really terrible community, or it's a far-off community, it's an unfortunate community, it has nothing to do with me, kind of thing. I think it's just, you know, that's the way people tend to think. We all have busy lives, et cetera. And, you know, yet, then it begins to crop up in other places. And that's why, in my view, every single incident of this kind is something that can and should concern all of us. You know, so stepping up from that, it's happening in my community. You know, when Eric Garner was wrestled to the ground in a chokehold by police in New York City for, you know, a minor infraction selling cigarettes, you know, they're not supposed to be using a chokehold. It's kind of been banned from usage, and yet it happened. And he was an overweight person, and they pounced on him. Someone made a video, which you can see online. It's very disturbing. And he died. And then just in the last few weeks, we've had a situation where, again, as in Ferguson, the accountable police officer is not held to account, but is kind of let off the hook. So we both have these egregious incidents, and then a failure to, you know, take responsibility and punish accordingly those who have overstepped the bounds or, you know, used undue force against an unarmed individual. Your comments on that?
Well, I think this is something that's coming to our communities. If it's not there already, it will be soon. Mm-hmm. We are in an era of mass criminalization. We criminalize everything out there, and then we're going to put you in jail for it. I mean, in Ohio right now, it's illegal to put people in jail for not paying their bills when we thought we'd gotten rid of debtor's prison back during the times of Charles Dickens. We are in this situation where we are jailing more people, both percentage-wise and per capita in this country, than anywhere else in the world. And so if you think it's not in your community, you're probably wrong, and you're probably just not aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's the meeting that we had at the Organization for Black Struggle. One of the statements that was made repeatedly by people there is that people of color, African Americans, consider them the canary in the coal mine.
Yeah.
And I think this is very, very true, especially like when we look at the situation of Mr. Bell up in Kenosha, who I believe he was 19 and was pulled over by police. He was, white, middle class, the type of person you're not expecting to have an incident or altercation. Mm-hmm. He was pulled over coming home one evening, and police shot and killed him. It was said that he reached for the officer's gun and that there was a struggle. And in fact, there was no proof that there was ever any struggle or that Mr. Bell reached for the gun. That being said, his father, who is retired in the military, he was horrified. But he thought there would be some accountability, however. And in fact, there was none. The police officers walked, just like they have in many of these cases, because the people who reviewed their behavior were themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So the state of Wisconsin this year actually finally had their law changed, where now they do have to have an independent review board put in place to assist, and that one of those independents has to actually lead the investigation. I think this is a step in the right direction. But there's so much more that needs to be done. And the fact is, as I said, if it hasn't gotten your community yet, it's going to be there, because this is really a war on the citizens. It's a war on those who are poor. It is a war on those who have less. It is a war on those who don't realize that they have something to be taken from them. I mean, if you're sitting there and you're unaware, something may happen to you.
Mm-hmm.
Because what we have right now is a police force that has largely been trained in the style of dealing with terrorists, in military-style training. There's no longer shooting to incapacitate a criminal. It's shooting to kill, and that is how our officers are trained. Many of them are veterans from the war. I think most psychologists and psychiatrists would tell you that that is always a poor choice in terms of how to choose a police force. These people often often have trouble due to PTSD and other such issues. some of them may make very good police officers, but the fact is that those evaluations that would make such a determination are no longer being done. And in fact, they disappeared back in the early 70s because at that time it was determined we wanted to make sure our veterans had jobs, and so they got rid of those psychological evaluations and said, let's just hire veterans. And consequently, we saw a sharp increase in the number of suspects being shot and the number of officers discharging their weapons. And that trajectory has continued and put us where we are today.
You know, that's a very, very important insight. You know, I mean, in part of the military training, you know, in a war situation, in a war zone, is to, you know, it's kind of an either me or you or my, you know, or you or me and my comrades kind of thing. And the normal controls that anyone would have are deliberately stripped away by military training.
Yeah.
And, you know, so that's actually very opposite of what you want when people are interacting in any way with citizens, civilians of your own country. I mean, it's in fact
right.
sad and tragic that that kind of behavior needs to be directed, you know, or is conceived of as needing to be directed toward anyone on Earth. You know,
and there, you know, there's two other pieces to that as well. And the fact that one is many of our military, they're returning from war, and then they're going into a job in a police department, and in a sense, what their psychological needs are being ignored and not being met, because God knows they should not be put in a job like that if they have issues from the fact that they had to serve in Iraq or Afghanistan or some other place where they ended up with problems due to the consequences of their surroundings. So that's one issue. And the other issue is the fact that not only are the officers being put into a situation that probably is not the best for their mental health,
right.
but the other problem that we see is that this is an issue. This is an issue of how we are training our officers. We have created a militaristic system of us against them, and in doing so, they are seeing the community as the other, and not themselves being part of that community. And additionally, because they've stripped away that psychological testing component, because they want to make sure that people who've served in the military have a job in, you know, the police force, that means that they're also not being tested for other issues that they may have. There's a host of psychological issues that might feed into making you not be the best candidate for being a community officer and peacekeeper. So those things also are out of check. And so basically we are creating a police force where it's not healthy for the officers themselves, and it's certainly not healthy for the community. And we're seeing the results. And even the other day I noticed that there were actually some police officers that were joining the protests in relation to Michael Brown and Eric Garner.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think a lot of officers realize they're being put in this position and they don't want to be there. And I can't imagine that there aren't many officers who feel the same way.
Mm-hmm. 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 I mean, it is... It is just shocking that instead of them being allowed to heal and all those services, as you said, were cut or hidden, or there's a, you know, there are still some that go on, but there's a stigma attached to it, all of that. And, you know, and then in effect, it's making the, you know, American communities and cities a militarized zone.
Yeah.
Because,
and
you know, you've been in a life or death war situation where you're facing armed people, you know, that neurology, I can say as a health reporter who's reported on trauma, that, you know, that neurology gets kicked in, whether you consciously want it or not, whether somebody, you know, they aren't even being told not to do this, but even if they were, it's not like you can just sort of decide. you know, because somebody said something to you in a course, how you will or won't react. You know, that's a big part of the problem. The reaction is actually effectively automated. Right.
Yes. I think, you know, and I think this kind of comes full circle back to, you know, one of the chants of the movement, which is Black Lives Matter. And essentially right now what we are saying in this country is that Black lives don't matter. And what matters is that I gave a veteran a job, that I supplied military equipment to a police department, since we have a contract with military, with this military defense company, and we've already bought the equipment, and I don't know where to put it. What matters is, what we're hearing, is the money. And if the money is what matters, then not only do Black lives not matter, but nobody's life matters. Because ultimately what matters is the dollar. And until we as a nation can come together and say what matters is Black lives and every other life on this planet, until we can start saying that and say, you know, the money is nice, but it is not the primary thing on the table. Until we can come to that conclusion, this is going to continue to go on. And so I think, you know, today actually is International Human Rights Day. It was established in 1950. And the theme of their campaign this year is that human rights should be 365 every single day of the year. And that's really what we're looking at. Our people is a human being's ability to live and survive, to have the right to live their life. Isn't that more important than a dollar? And I think it's a question we have to ask ourselves right now in this country, because we're all the money's, it's all about money right now. It's all about money in the corporate structure. It's money in the politics. It's money in the healthcare system. It's money, you know, about with the tearing apart the environmental movement. It doesn't matter what it is. But it is about the money. And racism and sexism are the two pillars that they are using to tear people apart so that they cannot come together in community and to change the world for the better. And it is a divide and conquer mechanism that is being used.
Yeah, we were actually, you and I had discussed this in the past, not, you know, on the program per se, but and we're kind of coming down to our last 2 minutes of the program, so we'll probably have to bring you on to, again, to have that conversation further. But I see this as well. I see the environmental community dividing against the health community. You know, detoxification doesn't exist. Toxins, unless we have the science, we're going to ignore them. And, you know, so with the one hand, we think we're being science-oriented in holding forth for climatological science, but then when it comes to healthcare science, you know, people who don't know better want to show how science-oriented they are by adopting, you know, basically scientific technologies, which are very helpful, needed, and good for, you know, identifying pharmaceutical medicines, which, you know, many people do use, but they don't identify what we really, you know, how we're harming health on a mental health level, on a biochemical level, on all levels. So that's my little, you know, kind of stand up on that one. And, you know, maybe in a future show we'll discuss that further. But that's one example of how people are being divided. So, you know, I take heart from the work that you are doing, from the people that have been showing up all across the nation. You know, just yesterday in Grand Central Station, the station was filled with people placing themselves in a chokehold and saying, "I can't breathe," the very words of Eric Garner. I think people are, you know, maybe a group of anthropologists at the National Natural History Museum here in town laid down on the floor during their conference in a die-off. die-in event in order to mimic, and protest what people have been subject to and are experiencing. But I don't think people are going to take this lying down. I think more and more people are rising up around these issues. And it's due to your work, the work of progressive Democrats, and your work, Jean Marie, you know, for which we have to be very grateful. Listeners, if you want to learn more and follow the activities of progressive Democrats, you can go to their website, which is pda.org, and, you know, kind of read about and get educated, and we'll certainly bring you back to Connect the Dots, Jean, in the near future again to continue exploring this important topic. So thank you for being with us again.
Thank you, Allison. It was a pleasure to be on the show today.
And thank you, listeners, for paying attention and being involved and building our own awareness, which we do every day, as time goes by. And thank you for listening to this edition of Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy. Come back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. And here's to your well-being and the well-being of our society.